Your Honor, we the jury find the defendant Sweet Tango Apples guilty on all counts of being the crispiest, sweetest, zestiest, most delicious tasting apple you can buy.
Order! Order in this courtroom! Bailiff, come back here. Where are you going?
I'm going with them. I want some Sweet Tango Apples too.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at sweettango.com.
Hello, and welcome to Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. Almost everywhere we go now, we are tracked. And whenever we are in a public place like a store or a hotel, we are most likely being filmed. I don't have a problem with that. I've owned quite a few businesses in my lifetime, and best believe cameras are a business owner's best friend. If you're not doing anything wrong, why would you care if you're being filmed, right? As a result of so many businesses and homeowners now using cameras to protect their property and their safety, we are catching more and more crimes on tape. But even so, it is rare to catch an actual murder on film. We are used to seeing sketchy behavior, even criminals caught on camera, but it is not often that we see the actual death of another human being caught on tape. This case is the exception, and it wasn't just a murder that was caught on camera, it was a murder by crossbow. This is the story of a very sick man who did incredibly horrible things. This is the story of Stephen Griffiths, the crossbow cannibal. Let's get into it. December 24th, 1969. Stephen Griffiths is born in Dewsbury, West Riding of Yorkshire. This is England for those of us that might not be familiar with that area. Stephen was raised in a very stable home, a loving home, and he did really well throughout his early childhood, in school and socially. If you were to look no further, you'd say he was an anomaly. We don't see children, male children especially, with happy childhoods that grow up to become serial killers. But Stephen Griffiths' early childhood was not like his later childhood years. His parents, Moira and Stephen Sr., divorced when he was 10 years old. And Stephen, who was particularly close to his father, did not take the breakup well. Stephen began to change drastically. His schoolmates said Stephen always had been a bit different, but as his parents split up, his behavior became downright strange. Stephen started to collect hunting knives, and even though it was against the rules, always had a knife or two with him at school. And then he started to kill animals. We talk a lot about how, as children, serial killers and arsonists, rapists, people like that, often like to kill small animals. People might assume it's because those children are inherently violent, but that's not actually the case. Psychologists and doctors who study this behavior say the killing of small animals is all about control, not violence. Children who like to kill small animals have no control over their lives, and they are not allowed to express their feelings. They're not listened to as children, and that makes them feel more out of control. They kill small animals because a small animal is something they can control, and the ultimate form of control is control over life and death. That is why it is very common to see this behavior in children who grow up to become violent adults. And that is why we should study these children and intercept and treat these children so they do not become violent as adults. But we are not doing a good job of that at all. Stephen Griffiths became completely disengaged socially. He withdrew entirely from school and from the social scene at school. He spent all of his time alone, and neighbors were disturbed by the fact that when he was at home, all he did was wander around in the yard shooting birds that he would then take back into his yard and disembowel. Now, here is something else that one of the doctors pointed out in a documentary that I watched to prepare for this episode. What she said really, really hit me hard, and I want to share it because I think you guys will appreciate it. I was really especially thinking of the Murdoch case as she spoke. She said, and I'm paraphrasing, children from poor families are often penalized and punished quickly when they begin to act out. It's almost as if we expect bad behavior from poor people, which is just something that's I won't get into that. But she said that children from wealthy families, even upper middle class families, when they act out, we dismiss it as a phase or a tantrum. We assume that children from wealthier families or upper middle income families are okay because they have a nice home life. And so very often those children are left to continue not only feeling out of control and suffering in that way, but becoming more violent as they age. Isn't that poignant? Think of all the school shooters. They don't come from poverty. They come from nice middle-class homes where people have plenty of expendable income, enough income to buy lots and lots of guns for sure. This woman actually said, coming from a middle-class home provides a protective layer from being disciplined as a child. Ton of bricks, right? Hit me like a ton of bricks, because we all know that that's true. She just really put it into the correct words. A protective layer. Coming from a middle class or wealthy family adds a protective layer to a child. That, it was very, very poignant to me, and I knew a lot of you would feel the same. That's the kind of family that Stephen Griffiths was from. When Stephen Griffiths was 16, he dropped out of school and quickly started getting into trouble with the police. He was first caught stealing from a supermarket. When the manager at the supermarket confronted Stephen about his stealing, Stephen pulled out a large knife and slashed the store manager across the face. Now, here in the States, that's getting you tossed into jail for a while. Stephen was arrested and he spent a year in like a juvenile rehab center. And when he got out, he enrolled in what else? Psychology classes. We've got ourselves another Brian Kohlberg, Ted Bundy, Charles Cullen. But Stephen quickly got in trouble again. He was caught with an air pistol, which landed him with community service. Apparently, Stephen felt insulted by a group of girls at the college he was attending, and his reaction was to threaten them with a knife and an air pistol, because, you know, that's a totally normal response to an insult. Now, this episode landed him in jail for 2 years, but not after seeing a court-ordered psychiatrist who described Stephen as a depressive schizo-psychopath who relished the idea of killing and maiming people. Despite being a diagnosed psychopath, Stephen was released after 2 years and went on to graduate with a degree in psychology in 1993. Throughout his 20s, Stephen Griffiths became more withdrawn and he became even stranger. He dyed his hair black and wore a long, shiny black fake leather coat, like a trench coat. He walked a lizard on a leash and he would take it, on walks through the park and like glower at people in his long black trench coat and his slicked back black hair as he walked this lizard on the leash. It was very, very desperate for people to see him as somebody scary and dangerous. Now, I love me a lovable weirdo. I really do. But unfortunately, that is not who Stephen was. His weirdness was like a movie villain persona. And it brought him girls, you know, as they often do. Sometimes these weird behaviors attract people. But the girls that were attracted to Stephen never stayed around for very long. They always broke up with him after not a long period of time because Stephen was mean and he was controlling. He hooks up with this woman, Zeta Pinder, who he met in a Lonely Hearts column. Zeta says that Stephen was very full of himself, but he was kind enough in the beginning. She was with him for 2 years when she found out that Stephen had been lying to her about living with his mom and dad when he actually had his own apartment. Zeta got a little upset with Stephen. She was like, "Are you hiding something from me?" And he said, "No." So she said, "Well, I want to see the apartment." So they walked to go and see it, and as they got near the front door, Zeta was horrified to hear Stephen say, "There was a woman murdered right here." She said, "How can you live here with that happening right next door?" And he said, "It's fine to me." Zeta said once they were inside the apartment, she was really disturbed to see weapons all around the apartment. There were knives and there were ropes, and then there was this giant crossbow. She also saw some books that she was not thrilled about. Zeta was so bothered by this that she ended her relationship with Stephen the next day. She was a smart woman. For the next several years, Stephen Griffiths existed in his weird little world, and he continued his obsession with weapons and with serial killers. A lot of us might be described as obsessed with serial killers, right? Difference between us and Stephen Griffiths, he decided to become one. June 22nd, 2009. This is Susan Rushworth. She was a 43-year-old mother of three and had lived in Yorkshire her entire life. Susan had sadly slipped into a life of drugs and was working on the street. On June the 22nd, she went missing and her family reported her as missing. The police took the report, but let's be honest, missing prostitutes are not at the top of the police priority list. But to their credit, they did look for Susan. They checked her cell phone records, they checked her banking records, they talked to neighbors and people in the area, and no one had seen anything suspicious. It was as if Susan had disappeared into thin air. 10 months went by without any real clues that would help police find Susan. And then it happened again. On April 26, 2010, this woman, 31-year-old Shelley Armitage, went missing. Shelley once had aspirations to be a model, but like Susan, had fallen into the world of drugs and then got into prostitution to pay for her habit. One night, Shelley met a friend on Rebecca Street. The two women had some dinner and a drink, and then Shelley went back onto the streets to work. Like Susan did 10 months earlier, Shelley then vanished like a puff of smoke. There was no sign of her, no one saw anything suspicious, and no one had any idea where she had gone. Again, to their credit, the police do an exhaustive search for Shelley. They search her home here, and they search the entire area of the home on Beldine Road. They found no sign of Shelley. On May 22, 2010, 36-year-old Suzanne Blaymeyers vanishes as well. Suzanne was going to nursing school. She was from a good family and things were going well for her until she too got involved in drugs and began to work on the streets. She had been working the night of the 22nd when she was last seen, but this time things go differently for the police. Just 2 days after Suzanne disappears, the police are alerted to the fact that a separate department has in its custody some very disturbing CCTV footage from a nearby apartment building, this apartment building to be precise, and then the police learn what is on that CCTV footage, a murder. A maintenance and security employee at the apartment building is going through the CCTV footage from the weekend, which thankfully is something that was part of his assigned job. This employee is just going through the mundane footage, drinking his Monday morning coffee, when he sees on the footage a woman burst from an apartment door and go running down the hallway. The security employee watches in horror as Stephen Griffiths then emerges from his apartment carrying a large crossbow. Stephen chases the woman down the hall, stops, lifts the crossbow and aims it, and shoots the woman in the back. The woman falls to the floor and Stephen then grabs her legs and drags her by the feet back to his apartment. After that, he walks directly up to the security camera in the hall and gives it the middle finger. The police view the tape several times and they realize the woman running down the hall, the woman who is shot in the back with the crossbow, is missing woman Suzanne Blaymeyers. As soon as the police view the footage turned over to them by the apartment building, they send a team to that building and directly to Stephen Griffith's apartment. The police are dressed in riot gear and ready for a fight, but they don't get one. Stephen Griffiths simply opens his door, puts up his hands, and tells them he is Osama bin Laden. Like, okay, Stephen, already playing the insanity defense. Stephen is taken into custody and investigators enter his apartment looking for Suzanne. She is nowhere to be found. There is not a trace of her in Stephen's apartment. Stephen is then taken to police headquarters where he is booked and interrogation begins. As Stephen is being interviewed, the police are hunting for any sign of Suzanne Blaymeyers. They bring in extra officers and the canine units and they search into the night and the next day. In his initial interviews, Stephen Griffiths admits to killing Suzanne Blaymeyers. He tells the police that there are, quote, many issues going on inside my head, and he tells them he knows he has psychological problems. You think? Stephen also tells the police that he won't tell them where he put Suzanne's body. Police then gather these images from local CCTV showing Stephen meeting Suzanne on the street and taking her to his apartment. And there are a couple of stills from the CCTV hallway footage as well. Just a day after Stephen's arrest on May 25th, 2010, a citizen of the area makes a terrible discovery. A man is walking along the riverbank about 5 miles from Stephen Griffith's apartment when he spots a backpack. The man opens the backpack and is horrified to find it contains a woman's head. The woman's head still has a crossbow bolt in it. It is the head of Suzanne Blaymeyers. The man alerts the police and they send a large forensics team to the site of the discovery. They canvass the area looking for more evidence, even sending divers into the water to search. The divers begin finding sacks, and inside those sacks are the dismembered body parts of Suzanne. The area is cordoned off, and later on, police find a toolkit containing saws and other tools that they believe were used to dismember Suzanne's body. Back at police headquarters, Stephen Griffiths is still talking. Without any kind of provocation or inquiry, he voluntarily begins speaking about other missing prostitutes. Stephen tells the police that he is the one who took and killed Susan Rushmore and Shelley Armitage, along with not only Suzanne Blaymeyer, but others as well. Stephen has the names and the dates of these murders, but he wouldn't give the police any details. So they begin to wonder if he's telling the truth or if he's just been following the news. Later on, criminologists will say that this is a common ploy among serial killers, and they actually learn it from other serial killers. When a serial killer gets caught and they know they're caught, there's no way out of it, they start playing a game with the authorities. They know they're going to get sent to prison, so it becomes all about what they can get while they're in prison. Stephen Griffiths has read a lot about serial killers. The shelves in his home were filled with books about serial killers, and he learned from all of his reading how to lead police along and give them little scraps of information, but also learned how to withhold information that the police find valuable in order to get some of the things that he wanted. During the course of the interviews, Stephen Griffiths tells authorities, "I've killed loads more." However, he couldn't come up with any other names. He knew Susan and Shelley and Suzanne's names. Why wouldn't he know the names of the other women he killed? Police press him, but they come to believe he is lying about the, quote, loads of other women. They come to believe he's either trying to get more clout and more press attention by making himself out to be worse than he is, or he's trying to make authorities believe he has more bodies to give up. They're just not buying it.
Why did you feel the need to kill her?
I don't know. I don't know if sometimes you killed someone to kill yourself or kill parents. I don't know, I don't know. There's like deep issues inside of me.
The divers and forensics teams continue to investigate, and by May 29th, 2010, divers found an additional 81 body parts in the river. The local citizens were absolutely horrified, knowing they had been walking by a serial killer's dump site for months. This was just a little river in the middle of the town. DNA testing confirmed that the body parts belonged to Suzanne Blaymeyer, and some of them belonged to Shelley Armitage as well. Once they had body parts for more than one person, it confirmed that the police did in fact have a serial killer in custody. Zeta Pinder, Stephen's old girlfriend, sat at home, shocked out of her skin that her ex-boyfriend was on television, arrested as a serial killer. She came forward to give police additional information about this very strange man they had in their jail. Police begin to look into Stephen Griffith's life, and he is most definitely a narcissist. He basically lives online, and he has a totally separate kind of like badass, bad guy persona online, because, you know, of course he does. Stephen also thought he was very, very special, and he wanted the world to know just how special he was. He also took a lot of pleasure in playing with the police. He loved stringing them along, and he loved knowing that the press was writing about him every day. Then another woman who had dated Stephen comes forward and says that after she broke up with him, he used to call her and leave her voicemails like these.
I'm not gonna go away, so I guess you'd better.
This guy is really a clown. He's a clown, man. A dangerous clown, yes, but truly a clown. Truly, you know, a tryhard. Very much trying too hard. Meanwhile, police are simply trying to build the strongest case possible against Stephen. They send a forensics team to his apartment building. Here you can see them walking the perimeter of that building, looking for anything at all that might be of assistance. A CSI team was sent inside to scour the apartment, and they were quite happy to find that there was, in fact, what appeared to be blood in the sink and shower of Stephen's bathroom, and they took swabs and sent those off for testing. The blood came back belonging to Susan Rushmore. Isn't that amazing that 10 months later, Susan's blood was still in Stephen's drains? The police believe that Susan was killed with a hammer, which was what Stephen Griffith's idol, Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, used as his favorite killing method. But they were quite convinced in talking with Stephen that he liked to use a hammer as well. The authorities, the locals, and then the nation were shocked to learn that there was a serial killer, a monster, actually, living in their midst. But what they didn't know was that this monster hadn't even begun to tell his story. May 28th, 2010. Stephen Griffiths appears in court for the first time. When the court clerk instructs Stephen Griffiths to state his name, Stephen stands and says, "Call me the crossbow cannibal." There was a collective gasp, and then the audience fell silent. Did he just say cannibal? They couldn't believe what they were hearing. For almost 30 seconds, the courtroom was silent, and then some of the family members of the victims began to cry. Psychologists would later say that Stephen Griffiths was feeding his narcissism and his desire for attention at every turn. This guy is such a media whore, he even gave himself his own moniker. That's just cheesy AF to me, to give yourself a nickname. It's lame. But of course, he got exactly what he wanted, and the moniker stuck. So now investigators had to look into Stephen's claims. Did he really eat his victims? How were they going to go about proving that or disproving that? Stephen Griffiths didn't care. All he cared about was the attention. Sadly, when investigators returned to Stephen's apartment, they did find victims' DNA on his crock pot and on his kitchen knives. So it appears that Stephen Griffiths did, in fact, eat parts of his victims. It almost feels as if Stephen Griffiths intentionally cannibalized his victims for the sole purpose of being able to say he did that, right? I mean, I don't know, maybe he wanted to, but it really does seem like he did almost everything he did for the most shocking outcome and the most attention he could get out of it. Investigators then introduced some evidence they hadn't told the public about. Stephen Griffiths had taken photographs of his victims. They introduced photos of Shelley Armitage bound and naked in Stephen's bathtub. He had then photographed her after spray painting words on her back. They also found voice recordings of Stephen speaking in his alter ego, which he called the pariah, and saying he was taking revenge on society. This guy is just a clown. 7 months later, Stephen Griffiths was brought back into court to enter a plea. It was just before Christmas and the courtroom was packed. They thought Stephen Griffiths might have another bomb to drop on the courtroom, but it didn't happen. Stephen Griffiths stood and pled guilty to the murders of Susan, Shelley, and Suzanne. He was sentenced to life in prison. He will spend the rest of his life in Wakefield Prison. He has since gone on a hunger strike. He has made some weak attempts at ending his own life. But of course, these are all control tactics, attempts at getting back into the media, back on the front page. Susan Rushworth's body has never been found. Stephen Griffiths will not tell investigators or Susan's family where she is. Why would we expect this piece of human garbage to do anything noble, decent? Part of me hates covering these guys because it keeps their names alive and it gives them what they want, more attention. But here is the thing, and I would really like people to hear this. Not talking about history means we are doomed to repeat it. Pretending something ugly didn't happen only hurts the victims of the ugly event, and it only hurts the victims of future bad events that we allow to happen because we failed to learn from past events. Sweeping bad things under the rug makes for a very bumpy floor to walk on, my friends, and that is why we must always, always remember monsters like Stephen Griffiths. In doing so, yes, we give them a little of what they want, but in studying them, they give us much, much more. Thank you for joining me today on Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. Hit the like button if you liked the video and subscribe to my channel if you want to see more from me. You can also join my Patreon. That is pretty much keeping the channel alive at this point. Our end goal there is to be able to raise money to donate to police departments that have cold case DNA in storage that cannot be tested because there is no money to test it. We want to help with that. You can find me on Patreon under Dining with Death. I sure appreciate your support. It keeps me motivated and it keeps me going. Stay safe, my friends, and be kind to each other. And I'll see you next time on Dining with Death. Bye.
Your Honor, we the jury find the defendant, Sweet Tango Apples, guilty on all counts of being the crispiest, sweetest, zestiest, most delicious tasting apple you can buy.
Order! Order in this courtroom! Bailiff, come back here. Where are you going?
I'm going with them. I want some Sweet Tangle apples, too.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at SweetTango.com.